Thank you very much. I'm glad that you came to see it. I'm a young ASA person. I just finished my degree in 2010 in bioethics, so I'm glad that I'm given the freedom to be able to present as a relatively young bioethicist. What I want to talk about is instead of going to my graduation in 2010, I presented a paper at Union College, and I came up into a conversation with a medical economist, and she said, "You know, it really doesn't matter how much we spend on healthcare. You know, the Japanese spend a lot more on housing than we do. It's just money that goes in the economy and in and out." And I thought, "Gee, what kind of postmodernist idea is this?" I mean, then I started to think, I better not argue with her. I haven't taken economics 101. But the more I thought about it, the more I could tell you that since about a third of the money that we spend in healthcare in this country is wasted, that if we just did stewardship that we've talked about already, then we would know that we have a problem and we need to cut back on that waste because that's not being good stewards. But unfortunately, this medical economist did not come to this meeting today, so she isn't getting the benefit of all of our speakers. If you go back to a while, the president expressed his concern, the government's concern over the skyrocketing healthcare costs, and warned that if costs are increased, not voluntarily controlled, could lead to drastic congressionally imposed mandatory controls. Which president? Not quite. It's Nixon in 1974. And what was he talking about? Well, what happened in 1965 was Medicare and Medicaid were passed. And Medicare and Medicaid were passed with compromise such that usual and customary fees were going to be paid, and they were going to be paid promptly. This is what he talked about in terms of those skyrocketing medical costs. And medical costs have varied over the years, and they kind of plateau for a while, then they go up again. The DRG, or the diagnosis-related group, decided we're not going to keep paying usual and customary fees to hospitals because the hospitals keep increasing their usual and customary fees 10, 20% every year. And so the hospitals are getting a real windfall from this. So we're going to just pay you for whatever diagnosis. We're going to pay you this amount for pneumonia. We're going to pay this amount for a heart attack. We're going to pay this amount for congestive heart failure. And lo and behold, that did result in some leveling off of the healthcare temporarily. A secondary effect happened around 1990, which was not related to government. It was related to the healthcare industry when they decided to do more with HMOs. And the HMO leveling of the increase, and this is percentage of the gross national product that's devoted to healthcare, when that plateaued, some people think that killed the Clinton plan because people say, well, healthcare costs are being controlled. Well, guess what happened? The next thing that happened was a revolt against the HMOs. After that happened, healthcare costs went up again. And what's happened over the last 3 or 4 years to control the healthcare costs actually is related to the recession. And who knows what the effect of the Affordable Health Care Act is going to be on health care costs. This is sort of the incrementalism that we've had in terms of health care reform of our payment system. And whether we like it or not, the Affordable Health, I'm trying to stay as apolitical as possible in this, but the Affordable Health Care Act is another form of incrementalism. So a lot of the things that are debated, the first thing that's always debated is, do we believe that healthcare is a right or privilege? That's always a bioethical question in any kind of bioethical class. Basically, we've decided in this country that you have the right to emergency care. Nobody has to pay for it. You can still be, but all these other services are going to be done by the individual. So those would be considered privileges. We already know also that the government is already heavily involved in the payment of medical care. One of the cartoons I've seen is a lady sitting there and saying, whatever you do, Mr. McCain, Don't let the government take over Medicare, because they'll ruin it. And it's been one of the most popular programs for good reasons. But right now, about 55% of all healthcare costs come from Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, and of course, insurance for government workers. To discuss healthcare, and if I'm going to try to do this in kind of ethical means, like I said, I could have just used stewardship and we could have been done, we could have all gone to dinner early, but I decided to use a different rubric, and that rubric would be that of Beauchamp and Childress, which is called principalism. Principalism was devised as a way for people to talk from various religious backgrounds about medical ethics, particularly on ethics committees in hospitals, to discuss a case and not to say, well, the Bible says this, or my faith tradition is this. Those things are not allowed, so to speak, but to talk about four basic principles out of beneficence, non-maleficence, in other words, do benefit, do no harm, autonomy, which means that the person or the is able to make the decisions, and then justice. So we'll try to go through those in respect to our current healthcare in the United States. Basically, as far as we're doing not too bad as far as cancer research. In terms of cancer, we are one of the top in terms of breast cancer survival and colon cancer survival. However, this is a problem. The problem is if you go back to 1960 and you look at the amount that was being spent, the life expectancy in the United States compared to these Western European countries and Canada and Australia, we were about in the middle. And our life expectancy increase over that time is actually, we're actually now losers to them. So it must mean that we're not spending as much on healthcare, right? No. This is what has happened to our healthcare spending over this time. Everyone's increased in terms of the percentage of their GDP, but ours has more than doubled based on that. As I've said, we're going to talk about the waste that's in the American healthcare system. Are we getting a good deal? Well, if you look at survival, here's the United States in terms of our life expectancy gained between 1960 and 2009. We didn't do very well in terms of years gained. Now, some of these were countries like Turkey who had a low life expectancy. But you can see that we are behind a lot of nations in terms of life expectancy. So we're not getting a very good value, if that's what our indices is. This was a shocking statistic. We're 50th in terms of infant mortality, which is another way that people measure how good or how beneficent a healthcare system is. And we're behind Greece, Taiwan, and Cuba. This is despite the fact that our cost of delivery is at least twice as much as it is in the closest country, which is Switzerland. And if you look at cesarean sections, it's almost three times as much. So we are spending a lot of money, so we're having a low-value system. So non-maleficence. So are we doing harm in our healthcare system? At least we don't have that, maybe you could say. We may not be so beneficent, but we don't do harm. Well, the Institute of Medicine survey in 1999 said that almost 100,000 deaths per year are from medical mistakes. And about 1 million injuries occur due to medical errors. I think I'd stay out of the hospital if I were you. It's not a very safe place to be in some senses. And actually, there's been a study recently from North Carolina, and despite knowing that, we really haven't improved that much in terms of the number of deaths that could happen. We've gotten electronic medical records, but the electronic medical records don't talk to each other. They're slow. Physicians have, by and large, not liked them, not only because of their costs, but because they're not very usually friendly, and they actually decrease your efficiency. This is despite the fact that over $38 billion were spent on electronic medical records. The thought was that if we reduce the number of hours that the residents are in the hospital, that we will make things safer. And they reduced the number of hours you could work from 80 from when I was a medical resident. I worked sometimes 105 hours a week. And they really have not found much benefit. In fact, the residents themselves, about 4 to 1, prefer the other hours because they had better patient contact. They had more continuity of care, and they learned more. But that was something else that's been imposed upon us. Checklists are drive you crazy. I used to do a heart cath in about 15 minutes. It takes me about an hour now with the paperwork, the checklists. We check again. Yes, this is the right patient. Yes, we're going to do a cath on him. Yes, we're going to go from the right leg. Yes, we have it marked with this special pin, which is used once and thrown away. I mean, it drives me crazy. And this is all done to make things medicine safer, and it's not been able to do that despite all that. The greatest harm probably could be, you could think of, is personal bankruptcy, which is difficult to calculate, but it's probably a factor in at least half the bankruptcies in the country is medical bills. And that's doing harm. That's doing real harm to many people's lives. This is what's happened to the reimbursement for angioplasty, which is putting a balloon in a heart and blowing them up. The balloons, not the hearts. But you can see that our reimbursement has gone down over the years. And so what have doctors done? And this gets back into the war that goes back and forth between the doctors and their consultants and the federal government and how they're going to change things. So because we can't make as much money as angioplasty, so doctors have done more echocardiograms in their office, which is the red line there. So you're doing more and more of those and doing nuclear tests. Now, the reimbursement that the doctor gets for the professional fee goes down and down, but because the technical fee doesn't go down as much, now the doctor owns that the echo machine, he owns the nuclear camera, he shares the technical fee, so he keeps his income at a constant level. Fortunately, at least in cardiology, we've decreased that in the last few years, but we do the second most number of MRIs in the world per capita. We have about twice as many CAT scanners on average as the average for developed countries. So what has happened is that we end up spending more and more on these Medicare beneficiaries, much more than the economic index would increase, which is related to inflation. And despite the fact that fees haven't gone up, the price and the cost per beneficiary goes up in order for physicians to maintain their business. And if we talk about the last thing in terms of how medicine is harmful, our disjointed medical healthcare system allows people to get pain medicines from a variety of doctors. Some people do this scandalously. Some people do it by accident. In any case, there's a lot of people dying of overdose of pain medicines. The United States has about 5% of the world's population. We use 80% of the opioids in the world, which is the morphines, the narcotics, and 99% of hydrocodone, which is one of the more popular pain medicines as prescription. What's happened, you can see, is that we now have over 6,000 women in this country and 10,000 men dying of pain medicine overdose. Autonomy, I don't want to... How am I doing for time? I would love to tell you this more because I think one of the worst things we do is for poor people. But let's read the definition of autonomy as by Beauchamp and Childers. Personal autonomy encompasses at minimum self-rule that is free from controlling influence, interference of others. A person of diminished autonomy is in some sense, in some respect, controlled by others or incapable of deliberating or acting on the basis of his or her desires and plans. Autonomy has been used extensively in terms of we've got to let the people make their own decisions. We got to, do they want to turn off the ventilator? Do they not want to turn off the ventilator? Do they want to have the surgery? Do they not want to have the surgery? And that opposed to paternalism, which was the old model where now, we'll take care of it. Just trust us. We're going to go ahead and do this operation. Now we have elaborate forms, 4 or 5 pages long. If you read your fine 8-font permit for operation, good luck. That's part of what is autonomy. I think autonomy, and a very more important part of autonomy, is the way this healthcare cost has affected us. And I have to go through this very quickly. I to talk about the, yeah, I see that. We'll talk about, first of all, Medicare people. I see this all the time. People who are poor people, their cost of a health care plan for their family is going to be as much as the minimum wage they might earn. So what do? If they get on Medicaid, they don't want to get off Medicaid, even though they have to keep their income low, they have to lie about their income, they have to take cash payments, they have to not get live together but not be married because the two incomes puts them over that. That very restricts them from doing the right thing and from being able to move up in terms of wealth. The other problem is that of disability, which I'm not going to take any time on. It's a whole talk in itself, but Social Security disability is growing fast, and it is going to take a higher and higher percentage of our budget. It does take a long time to exhaust all your appeals, and all this time you're encouraged by your lawyer, if you are going for Social Security disability, not to work. That reduces a person's autonomy. I'll talk briefly about if you are a postdoc and you realize now you no longer have health insurance, you can go ahead and go buy a health insurance. But remember, if you have a family of four and you're making $30,000 a year as a postdoc, you can decide whether you want to buy a house or not, or whether you want to pay for your health insurance. Where are we at? This is interfering with the autonomy of a lot of middle. Now, the Affordable Health Care Act will give reimbursements based on your income up to four times the federal poverty level, which is $88,000. But again, that gets more people into a government program, which then restricts you, gives you some restriction on how much you want to earn, and it interferes with your autonomy. And the level of healthcare plan is going to be, they're pegging it to be a 70-30 plan. We don't have time to talk about this, but they've deferred these sorts of things as well. What I really want to get into is, in the last few minutes, is to talk about how it's affected the autonomy of the federal government and our ability to respond to this. If you look, Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are about 45% of the expenses of the federal government. That plus interest is over half of the expenses of the federal government right now. The problem is that they are growing at a more rapid rate. Medicare and Medicaid are growing at about 8% per year. And that's not related to being old necessarily, because Social Security is only growing about 1% to 2% a year. The expenses of Medicare and Medicaid are growing because of the higher cost of the rapid growth of medical care. And if we don't do anything about it, somewhere between 2030 and 2040, Medicare, Social Security, and the payment on the debt will take the whole federal budget. We'll take all the revenues that we'll get in. So what does that mean? The federal government has another problem, and that's the problem of cash flow, in that in the past, Medicare and Medicare trust funds actually bought government bonds, so they put them aside, and, of course, the federal government spent it. The Medicare trust fund is around $350 million or so, and the Social Security Trust Fund is around $4.2 trillion or so. But those monies are going to be depleted, and it's a cash flow problem because they promised this. So this is going to have to come out of general tax revenue. So it becomes more and more difficult to be able to pay those things off. So there's lots of proposals to do that. There are means testing for Part A so that richer people like myself, when I retire, will have to pay more, raising the age. You can increase the deductibles, co-payments, so that you don't have to have such a great Social Security benefit. You can supply a premium support, which is what the Republicans had proposed for those under 55. You're going to get $8,000 to buy health insurance. You have to buy it on the open market. Social Security disability is actually in a bigger problem, although Social Security is not going to go bankrupt. The trust fund that is for Social Security disability is going out probably in the next 3 years. It's going to be a negative balance. The problem is waste, and that's where we get into it. And I need to just spend what are the waste in medical health care? This is a bottom line figure. It can be anywhere from 3/4 of a trillion, with a T, to over $1 trillion a year is being spent on things that are not useful. And it has a lot to do with the fact that there's no transparency in price. You really can't compare prices between hospitals. There's poor coordination of care. We spend a huge amount on administrative costs in this country because you have to have all the different healthcare insurance and all the different things to fill out. If we don't do something about that, and unfortunately fraud and abuse is only a small percentage of it, again, the healthcare will grow, so it's important to do that. The real problem is this limits the government autonomy. They can no longer respond to real medical threats. They can no longer respond to natural disasters. They have a decreased ability to regulate capitalism. There are holes in when the sequester came into effect, most programs were reduced by about 8 to 10%. Medicaid was not reduced at all. Medicare was reduced by 2%. And Social Security and other pension funds were not reduced at all. Theoretically, they shouldn't be. So if we're not going to reduce these drivers of what's really causing the increase in deficit, it's really not fair. And the problem with justice is the last thing is that applies that everyone should be treated equally. The problem is that we're already getting cuts, and we're going to get continued cuts in research, education, transportation. The autonomy of the federal government is going to be reduced. And this is going to affect young people disproportionately. If you're 30 years of age and you're going to get Medicare in 36 years, or you're Medicaid and you're already on Medicaid, you're going to have a much different package. You're going to have a much different Medicaid if we're going at the course we are now. You're going to have all these bad things. You're going to have to get a lower age. You're going to have less benefits. You're going to have less money. So his Medicaid is going to be smaller, because we have sort of a bloated plan for the people right now. We're spending too much money. We're wasting money. So what can we do? How can we make a difference? We can eliminate waste. We can liberate the disabled, which I didn't really talk about, so they could work. We can provide basic health care for all and use the savings to move towards more universal employment. And this will correct our bloation and hopefully balance things out. And I'm sorry I took more than time than I should have. Yes, Keith.
Yeah, one thing that you didn't talk about figuring out costs and services is preventive care versus treatment. And also kind of connecting to probably just American lifestyle issues of eating and exercise.
Absolutely. There's two things with that. One is that preventative care is somewhat overrated in terms of what it will really deliver. The problem is that our healthcare system is not really set up to benefit from preventive care. I suppose that Medicare and some of the new accountability groups may have some chances to benefit from it. But the problem is that we end up on our health insurance, those of us who are still buying health insurance every year, we go from one company to another. The only way you benefit from preventative care, really, is for you to have a long-term commitment, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years. The companies would like to do that. They would like to be able to do that. But unless somebody can commit to that length of time, which, again, is an argument for universal health care, where you can, at least a basic level of universal health care, where you can really emphasize or utilize the prevention and be able to make it last. Yes. Absolutely.
Of the country. Then one way to the major way is to do the same thing we're doing with cigarettes, okay? Maybe eliminate all food advertising. But that doesn't involve, that's something you don't think about as involving healthcare. Yet that's the type of thing that may be necessary if you really are going to take a really serious public health approach to really solving the problem, not immediately. You ain't going to fix it in 10 or 15 years, but maybe 20 or 30 years down the road might have a real benefit. But that's
Yes.
Yeah. You know, kind of along those lines, when you were showing those statistics about increased longevity in these countries that were spending less, then to go one step further, is there any speculation, or it's probably just a too many variable issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But, you know, when you cease, at least in the way you plotted it, mm-hmm. you know, a general clustering and a slope, you know, being conspicuously different, if I read that plot,
well, I mean, part of it is that it is true that the uninsured and the low-income people die at a younger age in our country, and that is again part of social justice that people, many people get concerned about. I have a certain degree of concern about it as well, and part of it is, of course, that some of the people have greater self-destructive behaviors in this country. My opinion also is that we've actually made disability profitable, and we're at the point now that we have 5% of the working population between 25 and 64 are disabled. That's a huge percentage. Now, some of the European countries are close to that too, but. We have created this disability, and as we create disability, our disability criteria is you have to be totally and permanently disabled to do work. Thus, people don't work, and they rust out, that is to say, and they become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then they get worse health, they get more weight gain, they get more diabetes, they get more arthritis. It's one of the reasons we have too much pain medicine in this country, because that has become pain has been rewarded. Yes. Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of things that would work very well. Having a common payer, or at least there's lots of smart people, and the problem is this is like a book length thing I'm trying to do this is like the first chapter of a book, there's a lot of smart corporations have studied how we could reduce waste, and one of the problems of reducing waste is that 80% of healthcare is salaries. So we end up cutting a lot of jobs and increasing unemployment if we really were to cut out that 30% of 35% of waste in the healthcare industry. But Canada has a single player system. At least they have single forms. They actually, I think they have different provinces. Somebody from Canada can correct me. But their overhead is only like 3 or 5%. We have an administrative overhead of 12-15%. Part of it is because people change insurance companies advertise insurance companies, and then each insurance company has their own people that deny, and we've made that much, much, much too complicated. The other thing is that Medicare and Medicaid's overhead is 3% for Medicare, 6% for Medicaid. And the reason that Medicaid is 3% higher is because they have to determine whether or not somebody's eligible. So they have to do an income background check. Somebody else, yeah. Yeah, I got so clogged up with time that I didn't get a chance. And I'm glad you at least give me the opportunity to do that. There is, I think that I hope that as sort of as a practical measure for any of us, when you go to the doctor, ask him if this is really necessary. I mean, don't be afraid to do that. Sometimes. You don't say no? Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. But I guess I'm trying to say, take it the other way. These are Christian people. What we should tell them is that many of the things that are being done now are unnecessary. Now you have this insight. Start to say, do I really need this? And I said this to my eye doctor the other day. I said, look, I mean, I have a vitreous tear. You know, I mean, what do you really expect to see in my eye in 2 months now? I said, I'm not having any more of the flashes of light. I'm not having this. And he said, well, you could have had a retinal tear as well, but I don't suspect that you would have let a retinal tear go. I said, yeah, that's probably right. I'm very tuned into this. But that you have to sort of, start questioning. I do that all the time now in my appointments. I say, look, I don't really think you have to come back for 5 years. I'm a cardiologist. You know, got a good internist. So he can take care of this sort of thing. So I think asking these kind of questions is important. And then to think about, gee, I want to be somebody who actually contributes to Medicare. Yes, Randy.
For the beneficence piece, you showed comparative data.
Yes.
For U.S. and the others. But you didn't show that for non-malevolence.
Yeah.
And you just showed some attributes there. Is there any data there to indicate that we're more like others or less like others on that one?
What do you think, Canadian physician? Do you think... Have you solved the problem of inappropriate? I think that European countries that have an integrated electronic medical record have a lot better chance of tracking things than we do. I think that and it's much. One of the problems I have with electronic medical records is that I'm on staff at 3 hospitals and I work at a separate clinic facility. So I have to know, I've had to learn 4 new medical record systems, all of which are slightly different. And in order to look at one patient who's been at multiple places, I have to go into each of these different silos and to get that information out. I think that having that integrated and having all of those things, as the Europeans do, has greater potential. Well, that's part of the Affordable Health Care Act that's good, and that unfortunately it's caused people who've had already a good electronic medical record system that's been actually fairly provider-friendly have had to change to a more cumbersome system simply because of some tweaks that are in the Affordable Health Care Act that they couldn't add in, and it was cheaper to buy a whole new system even though it was several million dollars. Yes, sir. I've seen several things in the New York Times. It's a Time magazine, but I've seen it in the New York Times. It's had several interesting things.
They basically devoted the entire issue.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I did see that article, yeah. Yeah, it's extravagant, and I'll tell you one of the latest examples of that is that before I had always done my cardioversions, where I give the patient, put them into deep anesthesia long enough to shock their heart. It's not very expensive. Now we have to have an anesthesiologist in to actually be there at the time we do it. It turns out that the hospital can actually bill at a higher level. They get more money from Medicare and the insurance companies. And it has nothing to do with making the procedure safer. It does make it less efficient because we have to have two doctors at the same time and we're always waiting for each other. But anyway, I know you guys have to get to dinner. But I'm glad to stick around and answer and talk about this, I think, a very important question.